aspect of the evening you appreciate and what you would like maybe in the future, something to be organized. So please be writing something and filling it all out. There will be ushers standing in the on the aisle. Please be handing it over to them so that we can have all the questions that people have. But as I said, we'll be able to treat a few of them tonight, and then we can be able to take that further and be able to email answers or whatever to people. So without any further ado, let's put our hands together for John as he comes forward.
Okay, now I was asked to speak on another topic, which not even related to the first topic, so I have to kind of, you know, sort of get my brain thinking in another direction here. So I was asked to talk about specifically who is Jesus or why Jesus. What is the exact title? Doesn't matter. Something along those lines. All right, Jesus the only way. Yes. Okay, great.
Why?
Okay, good. So, you know, there's many ideas, thoughts about who Jesus is. I'll list a few of them. It's not a complete list, but it's a pretty good list. Some people would say that Jesus is a sage, which is not a spice that you put on your food. A very wise person. For example, I'd say Buddha or Confucius would be a sage, a person that all would acknowledge was very, very wise. A prophet. Now, the Jewish definition of prophet might be different from the dictionary definition, but let's establish a prophet as being someone who could speak for God, who could speak the words of God. A liar. Some people would say that's what Jesus is. Crazy. Those are certainly some charges labeled against Jesus during his lifetime, that's for sure. Messiah, which means Savior. Son of Man, which that has Jewish implications. God in the flesh, well, that's quite a charge. That's quite a claim. Imagine if your friend said to you, I'm God in the flesh. And you say, I'm Julius Caesar, you know? Legend! Now, our group, Apologetics Research Society, sponsored a debate where the opponent, if you will, claimed that Jesus is a myth, not even a real person. A man. In other words, just a man. He's a man. He's just a man. I'm old enough to remember that one. Or an important religious leader amongst many similar important religious leaders. That's a very, very common view. And by the way, I want to show some evidence for. By the way, I believe more than one of these are true, just so you know. They're not exclusive. You could be a prophet and a sage. You couldn't be a prophet and a liar, though. I don't think so. Some of these contradict just a man and God in the flesh. That clearly contradicts. And I don't, if anything I say tonight even creates the impression I'm trying to put down another religion or you know, defame or say anything bad about any other religion, that's not my intent. If I come across that way, then just help me out later. That's not my intent. But I do want to show reasons why I believe that probably the correct choices would include prophet, Messiah, God in the flesh. And some of these others are probably ruled out by the data as I understand them. You know, Mark 3, 22 through 30, after Jesus said a few things, the family said, this guy's crazy. Now, evidence is they changed their mind. In fact, we know from Josephus that Jesus' brother James was the head of the church in Jerusalem after he died and after Peter left. The rabbi said he's possessed by a demon. That's recorded in the Bible, but we have the Babylonian Talmud, which says something similar. All right? Crazy, in other words. That's kind of, old world lingo for crazy. Jesus responded to both of these by saying, that doesn't make sense. And I agree, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. What do liars do? How do liars behave? From what we know about Jesus, does it make sense to conclude the guy was a liar? Does it make sense? What do crazy people do? This is a rhetorical question. I'm not asking you to raise your hand and answer the question. Just think about it. What do crazy people do? Well, maybe crazy people go and tell the Pharisees that they're a brood of vipers and whitewashed tombs. I don't know. Who is Jesus? Is he simply a sage? Is he right up there with Confucius? Joseph Smith, that's a whole other story. I've got a book on Mormonism over there you can read if you want. Confucius, I think it was a sage. I haven't read everything he wrote, the Analects and all that, but he'd make my list of wise teachers. Buddha certainly would. I like Buddha, everything I know about him. Baha'u'llah, founder of Baha'i, Lao Tzu. I don't know if you can read that comic about Muhammad, but all right. So, is it just another means to reach some sort of enlightened state? What's a reasonable conclusion? That we're going to ask a couple of questions at the end of this talk. What's a reasonable conclusion based on what we're going to look at? And that would be a reasonable response to Jesus. So I'm going to look at a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to look at prophecies. This is a fairly simple talk. Fairly simple information. Doesn't take any scientific background. There may have been a couple of things I said in the first talk that might even have been outside of your range. I think everybody in here, nothing tonight in this part will be outside of anybody's range. Pretty simple stuff. Not hard to get. Jesus said things like in John 8:46, "Can anyone prove me guilty of sin?" And he said it around the people he'd lived around his whole life. I don't know, if I was hanging out with my friends, if I said, "Can anybody prove me guilty of sin?" they'd all raise their hands. You know what they said when Jesus said, "Can anybody prove me guilty of sin?" They said, "He's crazy." You know what they didn't say is, "Yeah, I can. And here's the list." Jesus said, "Before Abraham was born, I am." Not before Abraham was born, roughly 2000 BC. Not before Abraham was born, I was. He said, "Before Abraham was born, I am." And I am is the name of the Jewish God, which means I'm the self-existent one. Jesus said, "I and the Father are one." Would Buddha have said, "I and the Father are one"? Would Muhammad have said, "Before Abraham was born, I am"? Would Lao Tzu have said to his disciples, "Can any of you prove me guilty of sin"? These are good questions. Jesus said in Luke 24:44, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." Those are the three divisions of the Jewish Bible. So what he's saying here is, that book you've been reading for, 1,500 years or so, it was written about me. You can see why I got in trouble. And John 5:39-40 said, "You diligently studied the scriptures." He's speaking to the Jewish scribes, Pharisees, the teachers of the law. And he says, "You diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me." A bold statement. He's saying, your religion and all your scriptures, the entire thing was written about me. Now, that's either crazy man, or some kind of deluded person, or, I don't know, maybe it's true. This is not a mere sage speaking. This is not merely a prophet. What did Muhammad claim? He claimed to be a prophet. What did Moses claim? He claimed to be a prophet. What did Buddha claim? Not much, actually. He's a humble guy. He claimed to have found the wise path to enlightenment. Okay. Now, what I want to do then is I want to talk about messianic prophecies. I did mention in the first talk, the evidence from the Bible and science for the inspiration of the Bible is relatively a small amount of information. And by the way, I want to say this. You can't prove the existence of God. You can't prove it. You can't prove it one way or another. It's not like, 2 + 2 = 4. In all these things we ask, what's the most reasonable interpretation of the information? We looked at some information. I believe the most reasonable interpretation is that God exists. And here's the next question. What's the most reasonable interpretation given what Jesus claimed about himself and what we know about him in the Old Testament? And again, I'm not going to say I can prove, X plus Y plus Z equals 7 or whatever, and not to the level of mathematical proof, but I believe the reasonable conclusion is that he is who he said he was. All right, so we're going to be looking at Messianic prophecies, and as we do, I want to look at it from at least a somewhat skeptical perspective. First of all, how do I know these prophecies were written hundreds of years beforehand? Because perhaps some of these prophecies we're going to read, they were kind of, sort of tweaked with afterward. Possibility? Well, actually, not a possibility. The reason is, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Septuagint translation. The Septuagint translation from Hebrew Greek made somewhere between 250 and 200 BC. We have manuscripts from the first century. And the Dead Sea Scrolls of the Hebrew Bible, there's cave number 4, the largest number. This is the Isaiah scroll from 150 BC. We have manuscripts from every single Old Testament book except Esther, from before Christ. Now, do you think that the Christians could have somehow convinced the Jews to change their scriptures to make it look like Jesus fulfilled the Messianic prophecies after this? I don't think that's a reasonable thing. All right, so I can say it is an absolute unchallengeable fact that every single one of these prophecies existed at least 200 years before Christ. I believe at least 400. But let's just say at least 200 to be conservative. Fact. Okay, now, how do I know these things really happened? That's a good question. Using the Bible to prove the Bible can, to some extent, be circular reasoning. Let's be honest about that. For some of the information, we only have the Bible as the source of that information. And if we've established beyond a reasonable doubt that the Bible is reliable, then we can use that to some... But we have to be careful with circular reasoning. Now, what I've purposely chosen is events in the life of Jesus that we know are true from sources outside of the Bible. We know where he's born. We know where he lived. We know where he died. We know how he died. And we know some of the things he said, but not many, from outside non-Christian sources. So we have Josephus, we have Tacitus, we have the Jewish Talmud. I won't be looking at all these because it would take a bit too much time. We have established, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in fact a Jewish person whose mother was named Mary, whose father was named Joseph, was born in Bethlehem, who lived in Nazareth, who died in Jerusalem by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate. A few other basic facts. And these are the ones I'm going to be referring to in most of the prophecies we'll look at. Okay, some people claim that there was no such person as Pontius Pilate until they found this inscription that says Tiberius, Pontius Pilate, procured of Judea, etc. I won't go into that. All right, number 3. Wait a minute, maybe these aren't even prophecies of the Messiah. Maybe you read Nostradamus. People use Nostradamus, he predicted the 9/11 and he predicted JFK. If you read Nostradamus, some of those things are kind of vague. I mean, in fact, not just kind of vague, they're really vague. So, I don't know, again, taking the skeptical perspective, which I think all of us should take. Hello? All of us should take. If you can't be skeptical about what you believe, then maybe you don't actually believe it. Or at least, be a little concerned about that. So how do we know the prophecy of the Messiah? Now, what I'm doing is, all but one of the prophecies that I'm going to mention tonight are prophecies that Jews would agree, did agree before, and still agree after, are prophecies of the Messiah. The one exception I'll warn you about. All right. So in other words, if the Jews, who don't believe in Jesus being the Messiah, still say these are Messianic prophecies, then I say, probably they're Messianic prophecies. So Jesus wasn't taking them out of context and even told the people he's speaking to in his lifetime, I am fulfilling all these prophecies that they knew of. Okay, great. Last skeptical question is this. Maybe Jesus, wanting to claim to be the Messiah, the great one of the Jews, maybe what he did is he read the Old Testament. The Old Testament says the Messiah has to do 10 jumping jacks, so he did 10 jumping jacks. Okay? That's a good question. Could he have faked these things in order to be able to make these claims? Now, there's a problem with that right away, because these prophecies included dying in a very horrible way. All right, so right away, question number 4 seems to have been answered, but I'll raise that as we go through these prophecies. Okay? there we go. I'll start in Isaiah 53. You can read the whole thing. I'm just taking some excerpts here. If you read the whole thing, you'll see I'm definitely not taking it out of context. All right. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. Now, is it a historical fact that Jesus was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering? Absolutely a fact. All right. So, could it be that Jesus wanted to claim to be the Messiah? Said, "All right, now if I'm going to be the Messiah, it's going to be awesome. I'm going to have all these followers. It's going to be great. But I got to suffer and get rejected." Yeah. In fact, if you want to suffer and get rejected, go around telling people before Abraham was born, "I am," and call the leaders of the people whitewashed tombs. So I will concede to the skeptic that although it's a fact that Jesus fulfilled this prophecy, you know, could have been because he was trying to manipulate the people. "He was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed." Was Jesus pierced? Absolutely, is pierced. Now, he was crucified, and what happened was, you can read the four different accounts, they agree on this, that there were three crucified. Most of you know this already, but some of you don't. And Jesus, who was mortally wounded through this horrible torture that went before that, he only survived for roughly 6 hours on the cross. And it was the eve of the Passover. The Jews did not want to have these people being tortured during the Passover. End of the pleas, they did. They broke the legs of the two criminals that were on either side, because when you're hung from a cross, if you can't support yourself on your feet, you die within a few minutes. They came to Jesus. He was already dead. You can read John, who testified to all these things. He was there. He was an eyewitness. And he was already dead. They didn't break his bones. We'll see that in Psalm 22. And they pierced his side. And blood separated from water came out, which happens about an hour after you die. The serum separates from the blood cells. Okay? Now, could Jesus have arranged to be pierced? "Hey, guys, do me a favor. I can't explain it right now. My friends will help you out later on. Just trust me. I need to get pierced. So after I die, could you please pierce me?" He was oppressed and afflicted. Now, somebody say, "Well, yeah, John just said that because he read Isaiah 53, so he made up the piercing." Now, one thing I know about, I don't know if you've ever known a pathological liar. Pathological liars are very, very careful about the amount of information they release. They say, "Oh, yeah, but the Bible was written for years and years afterward." Yeah, like 25 years. All right, 25 years ago, I lived in San Diego. Do you think I've forgotten where I lived 25 years ago? You think the hundreds of eyewitnesses couldn't remember if that had really happened? 25 years. Yeah, people, you know, these people try to create the impression, "Oh, you can't trust anything. It was so long afterwards." Come on. Most of the people who were there that day were still alive. I say 25 years from now, most of you will still be alive. I bet 3/4 of you will still be alive. You think you'll be able to remember 25 years ago that I came here tonight? I think so. Okay? Anyway, he's oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He's led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before his shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Yeah, Jesus could have arranged that. Of course, the result was his death. Let's look at another prophecy. Micah 5:2. "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." If there ever was a prophecy that the Jews would say is a messianic prophecy, it's this one. Where was Jesus born? In Bethlehem. Historical fact. Which Bethlehem? There's two Bethlehems. Bethlehem Ephrathah, the smaller one, of course. Isaiah 9:1. "In the past, they humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali." Now, probably a lot of you don't know where those places are. I'll show you on a map. "But in the future, we'll honor Galilee the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan. For us, to us, a child is born. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." messianic prophecy to the max. This one will be born from the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, from the Gentiles. Now let me show you where Zebulun is. Let me show you where Naphtali is. All right? Here's Zebulun. Here's Naphtali. Now see the border between Zebulun and Naphtali? Next slide. Here's where Nazareth is. Right on the border between Zebulun and Naphtali. Now anybody wanting to claim to be the Messiah has to be born in Bethlehem, but come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. Anybody in the room meet those qualifications? How many who have ever lived meet those qualifications? Historical fact, definitely. In fact, he was called the Nazarene. The Christian sect was called the Nazarenes. Okay? Could Jesus have arranged to be born in Nazareth? I'm sorry, to be raised in Nazareth. Sure, if he's God. Could he have arranged to be born in Bethlehem? Absolutely, if he's God. Again, a reasonable conclusion is that Jesus is who he says he is. Okay? Psalm 22. By the way, of the scriptures we're looking at tonight, this is the only one that the Jews may or may not have seen as messianic. You can read it for yourself. I think probably they would have. Until after Jesus came, then maybe they would have changed their mind. An interesting historical note, a number of these messianic prophecies were in the weekly readings in the synagogues, and many of them were removed from those weekly readings after the time of Christ, for reasons that are fairly obvious. Anyway, Psalm 22, dogs have surrounded me, a band of evil men has encircled me, they have pierced my hands and my feet. Let's stop right there. How did Jesus die? Crucifixion, hands and feet. Historical fact. Tacitus, Josephus, and the Talmud agree. Did you know, because this was written 1000 BC by David. Did you know that crucifixion wasn't even invented until 300 BC? 700 years after David died. I try to imagine David writing this psalm. They've pierced my hands and my feet. Why did I write that? What's that about? All right, I wrote it. All right. Actually, the Persians invented crucifixion, but they crucified by tying of hands and feet. The Romans invented persecution by piercing hands and feet. 150 BC. 850 years after David wrote. I don't know. That's convincing to me. I can count all my bones. That goes back to the legs not being broken. Now, you can read in John 19 what happened. But again, I'll admit, most of the facts that I've already talked about are a matter of historical fact. Now, this one here, I admit, the only witness we have for this particular fact is John. But according to John, what happened was, They stripped off his clothes, and after they nailed him to the cross, they were dividing up his garments. One for you, one for you, one for you, one for me. And then when they got to the last, the inner garment, which was very, very valuable because it was sewn in one piece, rather than rip it, they gambled. I like to imagine those Roman soldiers, maybe one of them read, I don't know if they ever read Psalm 22 later on, thinking, well, that's kind of weird. Because, you know, we divided the garments, and then we cast lots for the clothing. Okay. How about Zechariah? This is a fun one. And Zechariah 11, 12, and 13 is clearly a messianic prophecy. Clearly messianic. I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. Now, how much was Judas paid to betray Jesus? 30 pieces. So how do we know that? Well, because they wrote it down, and knowing that anybody could have read it, including the dozens of people who are in that room, he didn't make it up. And I like to imagine the Pharisees and the Sadducees later on going, 30 pieces. Oh, man. They're reading Zechariah. Oh, man. It couldn't have been 40. Ah. Not 29, not 31. What the prophecy said is God. It says the price at which they price me. The Messiah here is God. 30 pieces. The Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the hints of price at which they priced me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver, threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. And again, according to the scriptures, which you can take as being reliable, it's up to you, but according to the New Testament writers, they said, what happened was Judas came in, he said, take the money, I don't want it. He didn't want Jesus killed, he wanted to manipulate him into rebelling against the Romans probably. So, and they said, we can't keep this money, so they used it and they bought a potter's field. I don't know about you, but that's pretty accurate there. Zechariah 5:20 B.C. Now, here's one of my favorites. Daniel 9:24 through 26. 70 sevens are decreed for you and your people and your holy city to finish transgression, put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. No one understand this? From the issue of the decree to restore and build Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Now, if there was ever an obvious messianic prophecy, it's this one, because Messiah, anoint, the Messiah, the Messiah comes, the ruler comes to Jerusalem. 70 sevens. My calculator, that works out to be 490. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, Daniel wrote this roughly 540 B.C. The issue to restore and rebuild Jerusalem wasn't written until long after he died. When was it written? Well, Ezra chapter 1 records the same thing as in the Cyrus cylinder that we saw today, that Cyrus said the people can go back and rebuild their temples. And they did. That was 538 B.C., but he did not give them permission to rebuild their walled cities. Actually, it was a guy named Artaxerxes. You can read that in Ezra chapter 7. In 458 B.C., the 17th year of Artaxerxes, to be specific, all right, it says to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. If you read the book of Nehemiah, you can see that's what actually happened. All right, let's do a little math. All right, 458 minus 490. That is negative 32, which is 32 AD. No, 33 AD. Because there is no year zero. All right? This is not hard to interpret. We know the decree. We can read it. We can read it in Ezra chapter 7. Now, a little bit more careful. If you read the prophets, it says, after seven sevens and 62 sevens. So actually, the prophecy is during the last week. So if you read the prophecy carefully, what it actually says is somewhere between 26 and 33 AD. That's really what it says. The most likely year for Jesus to have been crucified probably was 30 AD, not the traditional 33 AD. Okay, the implications are pretty straightforward. Now, if somebody wants to claim to be the Messiah, they have to be born in Bethlehem, raised in Galilee, kind of somewhere near Nazareth. They have to be despised and rejected by men. Well, few of us are qualified for that. All right? They have to be meek and humble and before their accusers. They have to get pierced. They have to be pierced in hands and pierced elsewise. Crucified. They have to have their garments divided and gambled over. They have to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. They have to come to Jerusalem to make atonement for sins, somewhere roughly 30 AD. And ride into Jerusalem on a donkey and be born of a virgin and blah, 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 blah. I don't know. How many people do you think would be qualified? Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am. Jesus said, I fulfilled all the prophecies in the law of Moses, the prophets and the Psalms. Seems pretty good case here. Accident? Or is it evidence that Jesus is who he said he is? And he also did miracles. Did Buddha do miracles? Nothing wrong with Buddha. I've already said, I mean, I haven't read that much of the Buddha scripture. I've read a fair amount and, you know, I like the guy. I'm serious. I'm not just saying that to be nice. I have nothing against many of these religious leaders, but Buddha did not work miracles. And that doesn't take any, I mean, I haven't worked any miracles. Are you cutting me as like some kind of dead weight person because I haven't worked any miracles? Right? It's not like makes you anything less because you didn't work miracles. But Jesus certainly did. Peter got before the people in Jerusalem. He said, Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited to you by God by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you, as you yourselves know. And nobody's saying, really? I hadn't heard about that. He worked miracles? Where was I? And the Jews did not deny this fact. The Babylonian Talmud says he was a sorcerer. All right, fine. In other words, he did miracles. They just had a different explanation. All right. Jesus said in John 10, 30 through 33, if you don't believe what I have to say, just believe the miracles. I just want to look at a couple of the miracles. All right. We could just spend, I've got a whole book on the topic. You could read it if you want. John 6:40. Jesus says, I'm the bread of life. Now, what's that? Like, munch, 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 made out of wheat or barley? What's he talking about? It's a metaphorical statement. But Jesus said, if you feed on me, you will never die. You will have eternal life. What had he done just a few hours before? He fed 5,000 men plus women and children. Jesus had a way of saying, here's what I am and here's what I do. And it's not like this was in secret. It's not like Jesus has a little circle of believers. It's not like Joseph Smith has said, hey, we're going to get together. You guys are going to see this miracle, just you. We're going to pray for a few hours and blah, blah, blah. And then put a blindfold on you before thousands. Who were there? Pharisees, teachers of the law, his enemies, people who wanted to kill him. That's who he did the miracles in front of. Probably 12,000 people. He said, I'm the bread of life. And then in Hebrews, John 11, 25, you may not know the story. Lazarus had died. And Lazarus was a good friend of Jesus, as were Martha and Mary. Martha and Mary sent a messenger, hey, send Jesus, your friend Lazarus is dying. Come right away. They knew he could heal him. Jesus didn't come till the fourth day. And he got there. And Martha said, if you'd only been here, Jesus, I know you could have saved him. And Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. He says, I know that people are going to read on the last day. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. And then what's he do? They go out to the tomb. They go to the tomb and he says, open the tomb. They said, Jesus, it's smelling real bad in there. Now, science says this is impossible. That's the whole point. Some people say science proves you can't work miracles. That's a nonsense statement. That literally doesn't make sense. All science could say is, if that happened, that would be a miracle. If it smelled real bad in there, and the guy got up and walked out, that'd be a miracle. And Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. And he walked out of the tomb. I'm going to look at that passage. I just want to read that one verse. It's kind of interesting what happens at the end of that story. Because I want to finish with this. John 11. We'll do some questions and answers. John 11. Verse 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. My response to that is, yeah, no kidding. You would think so. Yeah, Lazarus come out. He walked out of the tomb. 4 days after he'd been dead. And with him comes this horrendous smell. But look what else he says. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. Again, no kidding. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that all the nation would perish. Very ironic. So they decided to kill him. That day, there were two groups. The ones who said, he's the Lord. And the ones who said, we need to kill this guy. Okay? There was nobody who said, what a wise teacher. There's nobody who said, wow, what a great sage. Because I believe the choices are Jesus is Son of God, Messiah, God in the flesh, or he's a liar, or a crazy person. I believe the myth idea is ruled out completely. And so then what's a reasonable response to Jesus? What's a reasonable response? Again, I'm not asking you what's been proved tonight. What's been proved tonight is that I can talk for an hour and a half. Okay? But I think what we've shown beyond a reasonable doubt is that there is a creator, a very smart and powerful one, and that that creator sent Jesus into the world, proved through the prophecies and the miracles that he worked. I'm going to end it there, and we'll take some questions. Actually, we'll take questions from here, yes? Great. All right. So this is a question from a person who's a neuroscientist and an atheist. That's a pretty common combination. Of all the branches of science, the one which is most thoroughly populated by determinists is neuroscience, for what it's worth. That seems to be the case. He says, talk to me about why I don't believe that we survive death. I would say this, there is absolutely no scientific reason to believe that we survive death. Absolutely none. All right. Are you the one who wrote the question? So I would say, from a scientific perspective, not only is there no reason to believe we survive death, but you have every reason to be extremely skeptical that we survive death. Okay? You should be, and if you're not, you're not acting rationally. But I, as a Christian, I like to separate the things that I believe from faith from the things I believe from evidence. Not that you will believe the things that I believe from evidence. I just want to kind of lay it out there. I believe the evidence is extremely strong and convincing that there is a God, that God created the universe, that he created life. I'm convinced of those. That, I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying I'm convinced of those three things. I'm convinced the Bible is inspired by God. The evidence is so overwhelming that I have no choice but to conclude that. And I believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. Okay? Those I believe because of the evidence. I believe in life after death from faith. Faith in the Bible. Faith in the things that are in the Bible. Now, that's not an illogical or rational conclusion, because if the evidence is that the Bible is inspired by God, and those inspired writers tell me that there is life after death, then it's only reasonable to reach that conclusion. Now, I would say there's some evidence of life after death. I would say the evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead is very, very strong. Now, the argument for this would take, you know, about half an hour to present it, even the barest bones argument. There's a book over here, not written by me, that kind of goes in depth if you want to look at it. But I believe the evidence that Jesus died by crucifixion is very, very strong. I believe the evidence that his tomb was empty afterward is very, very strong. All right? And I believe the evidence is that there were hundreds of eyewitnesses who claimed to see him afterwards. And that leads me to the conclusion that Jesus did, in fact, raise from the dead, as was prophesied, by the way. All the other prophecies of the Old Testament were fulfilled, and I believe this one was fulfilled as well. It was prophesied in Genesis chapter 22 that the Messiah would be raised from the dead from the third day. It was prophesied in Jonah chapter 2 that the Messiah would be raised from the dead on the third day. In fact, the Jewish teachers, the Jewish leaders told the Romans, look, it was prophesied that he'd be raised on the third day. That's why they put the guard on the tomb. So I believe that Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day which is evidence of life after death. But I see no scientific reason to believe it. In fact, I have every scientific reason to be skeptical of that. Okay, and I can't blame you for being skeptical. So, and again, so you should investigate, if you're willing to, you should investigate at least the possibility that the Bible is inspired. All right, good. All right, have you heard any arguments against intelligent design? I'll say yes and no. Let me explain what I mean by that. First of all, let me define intelligent design. Now, all Christians essentially believe in intelligent design, I mean, almost by definition, clearly believe that the universe was created and was created with the design. But let me be a little bit more specific. There's an intelligent design movement, mainly in America, probably has very little influence in England at all, in the UK. But the intelligent design movement in America has this specific perspective, which is, number one, that you can prove intelligent design from science, and intelligent design is scientific, and intelligent design should be included in science curricula in the high schools. I don't agree with that. Here's why. Intelligent design, as I clearly say to my students in my science classes, intelligent design is not a scientific statement. It's not a scientific theory. I said earlier, I believe that the multiverse speculation is not a scientific theory. The reason I think it's not a scientific theory is, number one, it can't be tested by experiment. And number two, it can't be refuted by experiment. Neither can design be tested or refuted. If I was going to do a scientific experiment to look for design, how would I do it? I can't even conceive of that experiment. So anything that cannot be tested by an experiment and can also not be refuted by experiment is by definition not scientific. Now, by the way, I believe intelligent design can be taught. It can be taught in a philosophy class. It can be taught in a religion class. Now, I can be honest with you, I mention it in my college classes all the time. But it's not part of the curriculum. I'm not going to do a chapter on intelligent design. So I believe that intelligent design should not be forced into the curricula in our school in the science classes. Because, in essence, it's not a scientific claim. It's a metaphysical claim. But I believe in it. I gave a pretty strong argument for intelligent design, I would say. But my argument, although I use scientific information to make the argument, it wasn't a scientific argument. Let me say that again. I could lose you there. You saw the presentation for intelligent design, clearly. But it was not a scientific argument. It was an argument using scientific information. But a scientific argument is one based on experiment. Okay? So, the question was, have you heard any arguments against intelligent design? The answer is yes and no. Well, I've heard lots of them, but none that work very well if you're talking about the idea of intelligent design. But if you're talking about the idea that intelligent design is science and should be in our curriculum, yeah, I just gave one, actually. Okay? All right. And what I'll do is I'll do about four or five of these, and I'll just open it up if that's okay, all right? And I just did the first two that popped up. All right. That's not a question. That's not a question. All right, here we go. All right. Scientists have said that the cross never existed during Jesus' time on earth. They did? How could a scientist? Do you think that, do you have any evidence to prove that the cross did exist? Well, we have evidence that crucifixions happened. Which cross? Do you mean the cross of Jesus? Well, what we have is, put it this way, a cross existed because he was crucified. Okay? So I think this person is kind of headed in the direction of relics because, you know, there's many churches of a certain denominational branch that have relics in their churches. It's been said if you took all the pieces of the true cross that are in all these church buildings underneath their altars, you could make a house the size of a, you know, whatever. So I believe that there are no remnants of the true cross. And if there were, how would you know? Genetic analysis? Right? The evidence is that Jesus was crucified. In fact, Josephus agrees with that. Tacitus agrees with that. And how about the hundreds of eyewitnesses? You know, there's this idea that the Christian writers are somehow unreliable. You know, isn't it weird? Tacitus says it, obviously true, you know. Cicero says it, obviously true, you know. Suetonius says it, obviously true. And then Paul says it, well, he's a liar. You know, what's the basis for rejecting everything ever written by a Christian as suspect when everything else is, you know, there's an inconsistency there. I think I just changed the subject. But Jesus was crucified. Okay. All right. Okay, this is a good one. It's kind of a strange question, but it's still a good question. So they're talking about the multiverse idea. They're asking, is the multiverse idea the same as Jesus saying went up to the third heaven? No, it's not. And here's why. By the way, I used to think, because it does say that in 2 Corinthians 12, 10 or so, something like that. Jesus, I was caught up in the third heaven. Now, Paul. And really all he's saying is that I was caught up into heaven. Because from the Greek concept, this is the Greek, and the Jews used the same language. The first level of heaven was the atmosphere. The second level of heaven was the heavens, the stars and the planets. So when he said I was caught up into the third level of heaven, he was saying I was caught up into heaven. So Paul is not arguing that there are different levels in heaven. Now there's Dante's Inferno, that's all really nice literature. There's no evidence in the Bible for more than one level of heaven. Therefore, this question is somewhat irrelevant, even though it's a really cool question. All right. How does the Bible, Jesus, compare to other major religious figures? Well, I answered that already, I think. Who asked that question? Would you like me to expand on that? Would you like me to expand on that? Is there an aspect? Okay. That's Ben. I know Ben. That's a softball question anyway, coming from Ben. Thank you for asking that softball question. All right? Now, people will say that all the moral teachings of the great religious leaders of world religions are the same. Not true, but true to a rather significant extent. I believe God has put knowledge of Him in our hearts on some level, that we have a conscience, and there's a common understanding. I believe that most people who created world religions were sincere. Whether all of them were sincere, I'm not going to establish right here. All right, Joseph Smith, I don't know. But I would say most of those who have established world religions, I'm going to assume were sincere in trying to establish truth. And they agreed on many, but not all, moral teachings, okay? But Jesus is different in that he claimed to be God. He was different in that he claimed to be perfect, without sin. He claimed to be the only way to know God. He claimed to have been sent by God. He made many, many claims. He's different in that he worked miracles, public miracles in front of thousands, including raising Lazarus from the dead. All right. Good. This is a philosophical question. How do you explain to a non-believer the law of causality when he refuses to accept God as the first cause? All right, here we go. Cause, I kicked it. Effect, that thing moved. Is there anybody who does not believe in cause and effect? Are there any philosophers that don't believe the concept that things that happen have a cause? In fact, there's the cosmological argument, the Kalam cosmological argument by Craig, a famous Christian philosopher, and his premise is this. Everything that begins to happen has a cause. And I don't know of anybody who would disagree with that premise. And then the universe began to happen. Therefore, the universe was caused. And that causer, by definition, is the Creator or God. So I don't know of any philosophers that disagree. Now, God, but one definition of God is the first cause, if you will. The uncaused cause. Now, that's a philosophical concept that I would say many don't believe in, an uncaused cause. But if you don't have an uncaused cause, then how do you have a universe? One of the greatest mysteries of the universe is that the universe exists. Can science explain why the universe exists? Certainly not. Can any philosophy successfully explain why the universe exists? See, Eastern philosophy is universal, as far as I know, in saying the universe has always existed. According to Hindu, Jain, Sikh, Buddhist, Confucian, and Taoist cosmology, the universe is a perpetual infinite cycle of creation, destruction, creation, destruction. Is that true? That is patently false. We know that because of the evidence from the universe. So, how close is that to the original question? Kind of. So, I think the idea of an uncaused cause is a philosophical idea, which is certainly not a scientific idea. It's a philosophical idea, which I think it's a fairly strong conclusion to reach. But some people don't believe in uncaused causes. In fact, I would say, oh, my computer's about to die. That's good. We're done. I would say that, for example, Dawkins doesn't believe in an uncaused cause. There's a lot of things he doesn't believe in, but he does believe in it was all luck. All right, well, and again, I wouldn't go for that bet. Okay, that's enough of those. It's kind of boring to read questions off of sheets, and it's getting kind of late. I kind of like the interaction. So can I take just two or three more questions? It's a weeknight. Let's say two or three more questions. But from the audience. And if yours is on there, that's great anyway. So, yes.
So you said that there's scientific evidence refuting the idea that the universe is an infinite cycle that's going back and forth. I think actually quite a lot of cosmologists have made the argument that the possibility is that when you get the Big Bang sort of thing, tangent, that eventually you'll find contraction and the whole thing...
Well, more recent evidence... I'm sorry, I interrupted you for them. We're buddies. I can get away with interrupting. We're buddies, but... Normally it's impolite to interrupt somebody in the other question. I apologize. But anyway, more recent evidence from the Hubble telescope shows that not only is the universe not slowing down, it's actually speeding up. And I believe those who hold to the idea of the oscillating universe have pretty much disappeared. I don't know of any cosmologists who really follow that model. Now, is it possible through some mechanism we're not aware of and something that, I don't know, I mean, I can't rule it out, but I'd say the evidence very, very strongly points against that. I'll just leave it at that. Okay? Yes?
I heard that apparently scientists have discovered that it was possibly, in terms of the Big Bang, that it starts off with a sound.
That doesn't really make sense. Simply because in order to have sound, you have to have a physical medium through which the sound could travel those sound waves. And the initial creation instant appears to have been light, no matter. Probably what they were saying was it was not a bang. And you heard everything except the word not. Most likely. Because the phrase Big Bang was created by the people who hated the idea. Kind of like, maybe you're not aware of this, but the word Christian was created by people who hated Christianity. Those Christ people. And the people who created the expression Big Bang, those Big Bang people, it's a term of derision, actually. And it certainly was not a bang. It also was not an explosion. An explosion is matter going through some sort of a chain reaction thing and producing a lot of energy. It was not an explosion. It was a creation. A better term would be the big creation. You can see why certain people wouldn't like that term. The big creation. But essentially that's what it was, a big creation. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, I did not say the Big Bang happened, right? What I said is the evidence points in that direction. It points very strongly in that direction. We can't prove that it happened. Things that are that old, we can't prove that they happened. All right, great. All right, yeah, so he's asking questions about the time scale. And this always brings us back to the book of Genesis, obviously, Genesis chapter 1. And again, I'll go back. I'll start with what I already quoted, Galileo. The Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And I believe Genesis 1 is a brilliant, concise summary of what God did. But it's not intended to be a scientific treatise. And therefore, I believe the time scale is most likely a metaphorical one. Philo, the most famous Jewish philosopher in the first century, also believed that those timescales were metaphorical. As did Origen, the most influential theologian of Christianity in the first three centuries. As did Augustine, the most influential Christian theologian in the fourth century. This was a common misinterpretation 1,000 years before the scientific revolution. And the reason they interpret it this way is that's the most natural way to interpret it if you understand that it's a Jewish piece of literature. It's not a Western piece of literature using a Western way of thinking. So whether the writer of Genesis 1 had in mind literally 6 days or not is something that we can't establish sitting here in this room. And I would say the young earth view is not a stupid, idiotic, outmoded, troglodyte view. Far from that, okay? Far from that. In fact, when I teach my introductory science class at Grossmont College in San Diego, I talk about the evidence for the age of the earth, the evidence for the age of the universe, and it just happens there's several lines of evidence pointing towards the earth being 4.5 billion. They all point in the same one. As a scientist, that's practically a slam dunk. But then I say, but I have many people, I'm in conservative East County, San Diego. There's many fundamentalist Christians there. And many of them believe the literal interpretation of Genesis 1. So here's what I do. I literally step across the room. What I say is, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to speak as a theologian for a minute. Is it okay with you guys? I do this. I just. All right. I say, all right. Now let's speak from a theological perspective for a moment. Now let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-this, all-that God. Could that God create a universe and an earth with an appearance of age at the moment of its creation? You have to say yes based on you have no choice. So then the only question that's left, did God do that? I think you have to say, I don't know. I mean, how could I ever know? We certainly couldn't prove it wrong. All right? But the question is, is that what God did? And I don't think so, to be honest with you. I've got a few reasons for not thinking so. All right, but I respect and appreciate people who want to take that view. But what they shouldn't say is that science tells us the earth is young, because that is not true. It's just simply not true. You can say it as loud as you want, as often you want, but it's not true. Okay? So let me give you a couple of reasons. I don't know what perspective you come from. Not in order to prove you're wrong and I'm right, but, for what it's worth. For example, let's say I'm looking through a telescope at a galaxy that's 500 million light years away. Okay? The light is hitting my telescope. Presumably, when did the light leave that galaxy? 500 million years ago. Now, if God created the universe just a few thousand years ago, I've got a question. Does that galaxy even exist? It exists. Now, the God I believe in, like John the Baptist said, could raise up children of Abraham from these stones. And I think he made that fish. I think God could do that as well. Kind of strange. But if that's true, that means dinosaurs never lived. Neither did trilobites. God just put the. Anyway, God could conceive of all that and make it happen instantaneously. But I guess I just can't think of a reason for that. I'm using human reasoning. All right, so I don't reject out of hand the young earth explanation, but personally, I just don't agree with it. It's certainly not a required interpretation of Genesis 1. Anybody who says that is, I just don't think that's good Bible interpretation. Okay? I can take one more question. Oh, no, that's it. We're done. Thank you.